Hello, everyone. My name is Haley Sampson, and today I will be reading to you from Kentucky Living. The first article is entitled, Honoring Kentucky's Only World War I Medal of Honor Recipient, by Penny Woods. How does a nation truly show appreciation for the veterans who fought to protect it? No amount of accolades, parades, or holidays could ever be enough in return for the sacrifices made by these soldiers and their families. And though these events are certainly a start, sometimes a hug or a handshake means more than a war memorial, a museum exhibit, a written tribute, or a statue, said James Gifford, CEO and senior editor of Ashland's Jesse Stuart Foundation, who has written a book about one of those soldiers. Willie Sandlin lived a simple life upon returning home from war. Perhaps the stories were too painful to recount, or he felt he was just doing his job. Perhaps simple is all that was affordable. Whatever the case, his contributions and those of others cannot be forgotten. In his biography, Sergeant Sandlin, Kentucky's Forgotten Hero, Dr. Gifford brings to light the Hyden soldier's feats of courage. In 1918, during the First World War, Sandlin single-handedly attacked and disabled 3 German machine gun nests and killed all 24 occupants. In addition, 200 more German soldiers were captured. His actions earned him the Medal of Honor, the highest a soldier can receive for bravery. Sandlin was one of only 90 World War I soldiers to receive it. Upon returning to his Leslie County home, Sandlin's life was never one of fame and fortune like some of his military counterparts. His military pension was pitifully small, certainly not enough to support his wife and 7 children. He continually advocated for all veterans to receive the benefits promised to them while living in financial despair and ill health himself. In 1949, at age 59, he succumbed to a lung infection caused by German gas poisoning. After Sandlin's death, recognition came repeatedly, but Gifford feels like it was too little too late. With this book, I salute Willie Sandlin and all other veterans for their service and their sacrifices. I encourage everyone who reads this book to express thanks to a veteran. Kentucky Book Festival for Literary Lovers. Jarrett Krosga writes about his childhood with a mom who uses heroin and being raised by grandparents in his award-winning nonfiction book for young teens, Hey Kiddo. Hear Krosga speak and meet 200 local and national authors at the 38th Annual Kentucky Book Fair. Kentucky Humanities is thrilled to produce the Kentucky Book Festival, the largest literary celebration in the Bluegrass. We've got something for readers of all ages starting at the kickoff on Sunday, November 10th, said Sarah Volpe, festival director. The Kentucky Book Fair runs 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., Saturday, November 16th, at the Kentucky Horse Park's Alltech Arena, Lexington. Kentucky Equine Therapy. We ask you to let us know about other equine therapy groups in our October Healing Through Horses feature. We heard from the following 3 nonprofit Kentucky groups, all of which have certified instructions and specialize in providing emotional and physical therapy to children, youth, and adults. Circle H, Incorporated, in Maysville, serves by Fleming Mason Energy, serves 5 northeastern Kentucky counties, Bracken, Fleming, Lewis, Mason, and Robertson, and 2 in Ohio. Lovesome Equitherapy of Dry Ridge, served by Owen Electric, also offers equine therapy for veterans. New Day Ranch, Verona, served by Owen Electric, provides hands-on workshops that are ideal for groups. If you missed the story, you can find it online at KentuckyLiving.com. Lineman's Rodeo puts spotlight on safety. More than 100 compete in 15th annual 2-day event to test skills. Before the sun could break through the morning clouds at the 15th annual Kentucky Lineman's Rodeo in late September, Anita Garrison was already beaming brightly enough on her own. "He just makes me very, very proud," Garrison said as her son, Owen Electric line worker Brandon Day, competes at the Hardin County Fairgrounds. "It's unbelievable what these guys have to go through, seriously," Garrison adds, "especially the wintertime, summertime, storms. They went to hurricanes down south and people just don't understand. coordinated by Kentucky Electric Cooperatives, the rodeo showcases the skills and safety trainings of electric cooperative line workers. More than 100 line workers from 15 of Kentucky's 26 electric cooperatives competed in the two-day event, cheered on by their families and their co-op families. "I'm thankful for my family," Day says. "They support me in so many things, and for them to come here and be a part of this and see what I do day in and day out is really worthwhile." From chairs, bleachers, and vehicles that ring the rodeo field, spectators applaud and shout encouraging words as the line workers compete on and around about 24 utility poles. It was an honor to get to play the role of the host for this year's Lineman Rodeo. Nolan RECC takes great pride in line worker safety, says Greg Lee, president and CEO. "This rodeo is a testament to the statewide effort to preserve safety and build camaraderie among line workers." The individual and team competitions are rooted in real-world tasks and safety training, such as the Hurt Man Rescue, skills climbs, and a mystery event. When you get to come to a competition like this, you get to meet guys from other co-ops, and you just get the brotherhood that's in it, explains Christian Clark, a Warren RECC lineman. "I may be competing against some of these guys, but at the same time, I know they all have my back. We all kind of serve our own area, but when there's a big storm, an ice storm, or a hurricane, I've seen a lot of these faces out there working." With his wife and son watching from the stands, Shelby Energy line worker Richard Spoonamore competed in the Angel Club event. "The camaraderie is just huge," says Spoonamore. "People always talk about the cooperative being a family, and until you're actually working for them, or you see it firsthand, you don't really notice it. You watch them compete, you want to win, you want to do good, and you want others to do good. But at the same time, it's a little competition to show your skills." By Joe Arnold. Walking in a Volunteer's Footsteps, by Deborah Gibson Isaacs. Leading the way. Watch where you walk. Someone may be following in your footsteps. That adage proved especially true for Richard Steele, a line worker with Clark Energy for the past 6 years and a contract line worker for the two previous years. For most of his life, Richard was active in 4-H and FFA. Through them, he learned about livestock, but more importantly, he learned about responsibility. The cattle and goats all needed to be cared for year-round and multiple times a day through the summer, Richard recalls. He's proudest of the men who followed in his footsteps. Brent Maston, Dale Maston, and James Perkin from 4-H days went on to attend line workers' schools and now work as apprentice line workers. Richard understands why they wanted to become line workers. "I get to work in rural parts of my community," he says. "I have lived here my whole life, and now I get to serve the people I grew up around." Drone Detectives, Bowling Green. Stephen Miller, an electrical engineer with Warren RECC, is the epitome of a volunteer, including his work with students in the local American Legion to help veterans in need. Miller was at the helm when a group of local high school students recently watched an object fly slowly over an electric power line. It was a drone. Drones are giving Warren RECC a better view of lines and substations because they can get close enough to find problems as small as loose screws before they turn out into something more serious. The cooperative also uses them for thermal imaging and with solar energy and alternative energy. The students watching that day were members of the Warren Central High School Technology Club. Miller guides the drones and explains its potential. Volunteering with local schools and getting kids excited about engineering and technology is what he considers the best part of his job. "Warren RECC is owned by those we serve," said Miller, "and it is so rewarding and fulfilling to be able to give back to that community, particularly when it involves young people." Winter weather is upon us. How low should you go? Should I set my thermostat lower during winter? How much and for how long? Selecting the proper temperatures throughout the day and night can be confusing as you balance comfort with energy and dollar savings. It does save energy overall if you lower the temperature setting on your central furnace or heat pump thermostat. The actual amount of dollar savings depends primarily on how low you set the thermostat, how long you have it set back, and, to a lesser degree, your climate. There also are other advantages to lowering the thermostat setting during winter. A lower house temperature requires less moisture indoors to keep the indoor air a given relative humidity level. A heating system that runs less at a lower temperature means the equipment will last longer. There is not a best thermostat setting for all homes and climates. The lower you set it, the greater the overall savings will be. The amount of savings per degree for each nighttime 8-hour setback period ranges from 1% to 3%. Unless there are some health problems in your family, 62 degrees is typically comfortable if you are wearing long sleeves or a sweater. Important note, programmable thermostats generally are not recommended for heat pumps. Do not change heat pump thermostat settings more than 1 or 2 degrees. Consult the manufacturer's manual or contact your co-op energy's advisor for more information. It is a common myth that it takes as much energy to reheat a house, in the morning for example, as was saved during the overnight temperature setback. The amount of heat a house loses through its walls, ceilings, and floors is directly proportional to the difference between the indoor and outdoor temperatures. Air leakage also increases with larger temperature differences. When the indoor temperature is set lower, the indoor to outdoor temperature difference is smaller, so less heat is lost from your house. That means your furnace has to use less gas, oil, or electricity to create the heat to replace it, which is less than the amount saved over the temperature setback period. During the summer, the same concept applies with air conditioning. Bardstone's Band of Brothers, Loss and Healing 50 Years After Vietnam. June 19, 1969. Not a day goes by without someone in Bardstown thinking about that day. People like Don Parrish and Ronnie Hibbs, who were at Firebase Tomahawk when it came under attack in Vietnam. Time moves on, but lives were lost and changed, and it shouldn't be in vain, Parrish says. Betty Stone thinks about that day, too. Her husband, Charles Skippy Stone, was with them in Vietnam. Betty is now the cornerstone for information on Battery C. Their families still get together, and most recently, to watch a new documentary on the events that unfolded on Tomahawk, half a world away. 50 years later, Reckoning Day happens in fleeting moments each day for many of them. This battle didn't change the course of the Vietnam War, but changed the course of countless lives in Bardstown, the home base of the 138th Field Artillery Unit. Battery C, Kentucky National Guard. Just over 100 men in Battery C were ordered to active duty the year before, in the spring of 1968. Parrish was 26 years old and chief of the unit's Fire Direction Center. His father heard Battery C had been called up on WHAS AM radio. Parrish drove straight to the armory to get more information. I was surprised. Not many National Guard units were being called to active duty in Vietnam. Parrish thought they might be headed to nearby Cincinnati for riot duty with so many protests breaking out, but quickly learned that the final destination was Vietnam, providing cover for the 101st Airborne Division out of Fort Campbell. Hibbs, who was a gunner for Battery C, was painting a car in his garage when he heard the news on the radio. Even as they trained in Texas in the coming months, Hibbs says, there is still a little bit of disbelief. Betty Stone had just given birth to her first child, a son, when she got the news her husband was being called up. We had no idea what we were in for, she says. Skippy Stone would be headed to Vietnam along with his brother, Stanley. There is unease about the war, but there is camaraderie within the unit, and Bardstown supported its Band of Brothers. It was a Band of Brothers in the true sense, with seven pairs of brothers called up. In a town of about 5,000, you are either family or you grew up together. It's why those events on June 19, 1969, would prove so devastating for the close-knit town. As the attack was unfolding, the men of Battery C already understood this. Parrish says fellow guardsman Jody Hayden uttered the words, "This is going to kill the people of Bardstown." It was a rainy night on Firebase Tomahawk when the North Vietnamese Army, or NVA, launched its surprise attack. Heavy rains helped to drown out the sounds of their movement. Many of them were nearly nude, so clothing wouldn't get caught on wire as they infiltrated the lower spot between the two bigger hills. The attack began at 1:45 a.m., with about half of Battery C asleep, the other half on duty. David Collins was the first to be killed in capturing the enemy, surrounding the alarm that all hell was about to break loose. The enemy was armed with satchel charges, tossing those packages of TNT. The only light would be from those explosions. It was utter chaos, Parrish says. It was completely dark, like the inside of a cow, no moon or stars. Parrish was with Tom Razor, who began calling the 101st for help. But for a while, the men of Battery C were on their own with an enemy they couldn't see. They fired rifles, machine guns, whatever they could, to try to regain control. Parrish was in the only bunker that wasn't destroyed. One of his friends, Jim Moore, came inside, and as Parrish put his hand on his shoulder, he realized when it slid off that Moore was badly burned and was standing because it hurt too much to lie down. Hibbs had the night shift and was with three others in his gun, resembling a mini tank, when the attack began. I remember opening the back door to get out. Something thrown would catch my shirt on fire. I remember turning two flips from the explosion, and I landed still running towards the bunker, he says. Hibbs didn't think he would make it out. Two army soldiers with him would not. He would be flown off Tomahawk to be treated for his injuries and not return until years later. Gunships with spotlights from the 101st would begin taking their toll on the enemy. By 5 a.m., the attack was over, daylight revealing the devastation and the human toll. 9 artillerymen were killed, 5 from Battery C. David Collins, who encountered the enemy first, Ronnie Simpson, Ronnie McIlvoy, Luther Chapel, Jim Moore, the man who entered the bunker so badly burned, would die 5 days later. Bardston would bury its sons, overflow crowds spilling out of churches with each service. Stone, whose husband made it home, says it was an outpouring of sympathy and respect. Parrish says the healing continues, and it was part of that healing that would bring me into Battery C's inner circle. As a reporter with WHAS-TV, I traveled back to Vietnam with 7 members of Battery C in 1995 to revisit the site of Firebase Tomahawk. My dad had served 2 tours in Vietnam, and I, too, felt there was unfinished business with a war that took its toll on my family and countless others I knew. Parrish and Hibbs were among the 7 returning. They weren't sure what to expect, but felt a calling to go. Hibbs, who erected a memorial in his backyard to his fallen brothers, returned to Tomahawk to say goodbye, something he wasn't able to do after being injured and flown out. Some thought we were crazy to go back, that the war was still going on, but we were welcome back, Hibbs says. The warm embrace from everyone in Vietnam may have been the biggest surprise, says Parrish. Their healing was underway too, just as it was for the American vets. The men of Battery C used maps dating back to the war, found where Tomahawk used to be, and held a service for their fallen comrades, laying a wreath where so much loss has occurred. Each one knew it could have been him. I witnessed some of that grief, and perhaps even some of survivors' guilt, lessening just a bit. They found some solace, and in turn so did I, in part for my father and for families I knew who lost their dads. And now, 50 years since the attack, there is to be one more trip for this band of brothers, to Washington, D.C., on an honor flight. This time, more than 40 members of Battery C signed up to go. I was invited to speak at a news conference kicking off the fundraising efforts. Back with many of the men who revisited Vietnam with the WHAS-TV news crews. More than $35,000 was raised to help fund the honor flight, evidence that Bardstown still remembers. It will be an emotional trip no one will ever forget, Parrish said, before their scheduled departure in mid-October, after this issue of Kentucky Living had gone to press. With more than 30 men in the unit passing away through the years, Hibbs adds, "This could be our last hurrah." Betty Stone's husband, Skippy, was to make the trip, his first time to the Vietnam Memorial, and she knows it will be hard. "Life after war," she says, "hasn't been easy. I am hoping he can find some peace." Hibbs walks 2 miles every morning, and in that quiet time, he reviews the names of his friends he lost, his daily remembrance. "As long as members of Battery C are alive, Parrish says it's their duty to remember those names and what happened on June 19th, 1969. Brothers forever in life and in death." Fighting to Remember: Alzheimer's, Searching for a Cure, Learning to Cope, by Graham Shelby and Gabriel Billings. Paul Hornbeck's Alzheimer's journey began when the numbers stopped adding up. For this former United States Marine helicopter pilot turned engineer, numbers, mathematics, had been his professional stock and trade for decades. "Then in his mid-50s, I started having trouble doing calculations. I couldn't remember formulas," he says. Soon he couldn't multitask. He and his wife Sarah spent 18 anxious months consulting doctors, trying to find a diagnosis. "Some days a fog rolled in his brain and he couldn't see through it," Sarah says. "Then a brain scan revealed the answer they'd dreaded, Alzheimer's disease, which is terminal and incurable. I was probably the only woman in the world praying her husband had a brain tumor," Sarah says, "because you can beat a brain tumor." 10 years later, the Hornbacks, who lived in Hodgenville and are consumer members of Nolan RECC, are perpetually adjusting to a new normal as Paul's disease progresses. He is among the 71,000 Kentuckians facing Alzheimer's, which costs the state over $720 million a year in health care expenses, though its emotional toll on people who have the disease, as well as their families, is incalculable. November is National Family Caregivers Month and National Alzheimer's Disease Awareness Month. At Kentucky Living, we wanted to take a look at how Alzheimer's is impacting Kentucky families and learn about the work happening around the state and beyond to fight the epidemic. The closest thing to good news for Alzheimer's sufferers and their families is that more people than ever are mobilizing to fight the disease. Researchers in Kentucky and around the world are working hard to find a cure, supported by families and loved ones of Alzheimer's patients, and in some cases, the patients themselves. Alzheimer's is a degenerative disease that attacks the brain and gradually leads to dementia and death. It was first diagnosed in 1906 by German scientist Alois Alzheimer, who identified the causes of memory loss and behavioral symptoms in a woman who died at 55. The cause was an excessive amount of proteins in the brain known as tau and beta amyloid, also referred to as amyloid beta. When these proteins build up, and the reasons this happens aren't entirely clear, the brain's neural network breaks down. Think of your brain like a series of landline telephone wires. When they're working properly, all the signals follow set paths, carrying information from one point on the network to the other. Now picture, say, a tornado or an earthquake, some force that rips some poles out of the ground, twisting wires and crossing signals, destroying some connections. Some connections entirely, and sending others to the wrong destination. Over a period of years, Alzheimer's produces a similar effect in the brain, leading to confusion and memory loss. As the disease progresses, it produces massive cell death across both hemispheres of the brain, shrinking the brain and gradually eliminating speech, motor function, and cognitive processes, muscle, bladder, and bowel control, and eventually stopping even breath and heartbeat. Alzheimer's, or some other form of dementia, is affecting an increasing number of Americans. According to the Alzheimer's Association, between 2000 and 2017, while heart disease deaths increased, Alzheimer's-related deaths increased 145%. Nationwide, 5.8 million people have been diagnosed with the disease, and that number is expected to more than double by 2050. The families of people with Alzheimer's often face daunting challenges of their own. In addition to legal and financial concerns, there are serious logistical and emotional impacts for caregivers, often spouses or children, who find themselves in the uncomfortable position of having to essentially parent their own parents. Kim Crawley is a pharmacist at Laurel Senior Living Communities in London, and she also runs a support group for Alzheimer's caregivers. They always want to know, is there a medicine that fixes this? Crawley says, and there's not. There are medicines that can reduce symptoms, at least for a while, but eventually the disease overwhelms the medicine, the patients, and often the caregivers. We try to help them answer questions like, how do I get them to bathe? Crawley says, or how do I get them out of the car once they get in? She says the hardest behavior for caregivers to deal with typically involves swearing, nudity, and incontinence. And that's all I have for today. So have a great day, and I'll see you sometime next time.